Trumpeter Freddie Hubbard opening up Red Clay, the title track of his 1970 debut album on the CTI label. Wayne Shorter on tenor sax, Herbie Hancock on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Tony Williams on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and a solid program that I hope you will enjoy today. Well, it is the day before a very significant vote at the United Nations tomorrow, and eyes are on that vote. In her first act as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley in January warned member states of the international body that the Trump administration will be, quote, taking names, unquote, of all countries ever daring to vote against it. The former governor of South Carolina this week repeated the threat in a letter to representatives of several member states ahead of a controversial vote tomorrow on the U.S.'s unilateral decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and relocate the U.S. embassy there. Well, remember we talked about this thug action that Nikki Haley undertook in January, and we called it as we saw it. It was an act of thuggery, the bullying of the United States and the threats of the United States, the implied threats that the United States will take some kind of retaliatory action against any state that dares to oppose it on any grounds whatsoever. And Nikki Haley sent out a letter, this is Tuesday, telling several member states that Mr. Trump will take it personally if this vote that is about to be undertaken is opposed to the action that the U.S. has already taken by announcing that it intends and it does recognize Jerusalem as the capital, setting off, by the way, incredible reverberations all over the world, because this is a very delicate matter, as you know, and the cause for a great deal of conflict and friction, which, of course, continue. Israel is getting bigger as Palestine gets smaller. And anybody even conversant with the Bible, going all the way back to biblical times, Palestine used to be very, very, very big. And it welcomed everybody. Everybody was in Palestine, basically living among each other. And then came the war in Israel after a migration of mostly Eastern European Jews and massing, in a particular area that it chose to call Israel. We also had, I shared with you some, probably about 2 years ago, a lecture by Miko Peled, who is a peace activist, living in the United States, but is Israeli born, and the son of one of the generals of Israel, who basically planned the emergent nation of Israel through war. Miko Peled is against it still. But what he talked about in that lecture was the history of aggression on the part of this new group that pretty much invaded the land and forced Palestinians out. It's very much parallel to the experience in South Africa, where the Boers invaded the land, took it over, and essentially converted the people of South Africa as political prisoners, if you will. They were contained in various portions, geographic portions of South Africa, so as to utterly control their lives. And in the meantime, everything that they had owned, everything that they used to do, no longer could be done. Same experience here in the United States, where the indigenous people were forced out of their land, or if they chose to remain, this is after a succession of wars, they basically are living as a kind of political prisoners on their own land. Same experience. So there's going to be a vote. It is not legally binding, by the way, in the United Nations, but it will be a very symbolic vote, expressing the sentiment not only of Palestine, but also the international community in support of the Palestinian people, and rejecting the actions not only of Israel, but supporters of Israel, and United States being one of the main supporters of Israel, not just militarily and politically, but also financially. The United States, Israel is and has been one of the largest welfare states in the world, receiving billions of dollars for many years now from the United States, money that it gets in a lump sum up front, totaling some 90 plus million dollars a year. But the constant support, the ardent support of the United States of what is considered, even by Miko Peled, as a renegade state, practicing some of the most odious methods of oppression in modern times. It continues. It has continued with every president. The strong Israeli lobby, if you will, because that's what it does, and I'm referring to AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, essentially, raising a lot of money for Israel, but also intervening in matters in Congress that concern Israel, and they have an extraordinary influence on several administrations. They have had strong influence there. So this vote coming up tomorrow is going to be very, very important in sending a message reflecting the sentiments of the world community of nations. And we see that the United States, in taking this action that it has, and with Trump's expression of his intent to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of this state of Israel, implicit is, of course, the fact that he does not support the Palestinian cause. He has taken sides in a matter that was under international negotiation. So in taking sides, he has put the United States in the forefront of a very delicate matter that has been ongoing now for several years. And it has outraged the world community of nations. So here comes the newly appointed ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. And back in January, I discussed it at length, how outrageous her conduct was, how offensive it was, and how high-handed it was to talk to people this way, to talk to the nations of the world this way, as if the United States owned the planet. And she talked about the fact that the U.S., meaning she will be, as ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, will be taking names. And I remarked at the time, I discussed this matter. I said, what is she going to do? Show up in the parking lot with brass knuckles and, you know, remove her earrings and put Vaseline on her face and start a fight in the parking lot? What kind of language is that? How dare she do it and do it twice? That Mr. Trump will be taking it personally if anybody should vote against or express sentiments against the United States in the United Nations around the matter of Israel. What is that? Who named you queen of the universe? Who named Trump king of the planet? And it is so embarrassing for Americans to have the president of the country talk this way or express these sentiments and undertake these actions unilaterally, and to have his ambassador to the United Nations talk like she's a street chick waiting to have a fight. You know, she's got her brass knuckles in her purse. And she is spoiling for a physical altercation, and she's threatening actually threatening the General Assembly members, all 193 of them. This is outrageous behavior. But it is not alarming, it seems, in Washington, D.C., in the White House, and in Congress. It doesn't seem to be untoward conduct. It doesn't seem to bother people that this is the behavior. This is, I mean, and to do it twice means that when she did it the first time back in January, telling people she'll be taking names. What, are you going to send them to the principal's office, or are you going to, you know, bomb them, bomb their countries? What are you going to do? What is this threatening behavior all about? And Trump is going to take it personally. Well, let him take it personally. But he's dead wrong. And so is she, dead wrong in the way they have conducted themselves within the world community of nations. Nobody behaves like that. Yeah. It's so alarming. And she is, I mean, more fascistic and more warlike than even Trump, if you could imagine that. I mean, she is a super, what do you call that? Extortionist? A terrorist? If you're going to threaten people if they happen to vote against the United States? And they will, by the way, be quite correct to do so. And Trump stands alone. This is the whole thing. When the matter came up in the Security Council about Trump doing this, he was in the majority of one. 14 other nations just let him have it. You're going to come in like the big bad wolf because, you know, there's such a heavy Israeli lobby in the United States. And they have ruled every single president in recent memory. They get exactly what they want. They break laws. Netanyahu, as we speak, is under investigation, criminal investigation. His wife has been charged with criminal activity, defrauding the government. It's not like he is as pure as a driven snow and has a record of conducting himself and the business of the nation with any degree of integrity. You may recall when he had the nerve and the pressure was put on American legislators in Congress to accept him coming into Congress to wag an accusing finger at the President of the United States. He came in the midst of Congress to do that. They allowed him to do that. And by the way, also keeping intact the millions and millions of dollars that Israel receives in free money at a time that we have some serious problems to address here. We're hearing all the time now, in the midst of this budget, that the country is going to be forced to now add to its 666, very interesting number, 666, deficit, $1.5 trillion, which, by the way, has budgeted again its customary payout to Israel. So Israel has inordinate pull, inordinate control in the United States, which is questionable and should be questionable to Americans, but it continues. But I'm going back to this idea of this brazen hussy speaking like that as the top diplomat or a top diplomat of the United States representing this country at the United Nations, threatening countries and saying, you guys better toe the line, as a representative of a country that supposedly cherishes free speech and that cherishes the right of self-governance and sovereignty. This woman wags her finger and sends out missiles, letters, not missives, but missiles to countries that she suspects will oppose the U.S.'s actions. And she takes it upon herself. Of course, these are instructions, one would imagine, that are coming down from on high at the White House, that this is what she ought to do. This is the stance she ought to take. And they seem to be very proud of her in behaving like a thug and a super fascist. I think people need to get concerned about that. Because if she's behaving this way out in the open, you could imagine what's going on behind closed doors. As the emissary of the United States, I mean, it is alarming because the one place that was designed to promote interaction and peace and some kind of a civilized relationship between and among nations, that's what the United Nations was for. It is hard to imagine that the interpretation of that by the current administration is that the current administration has the power and authority to threaten people on the basis of their positions, their very principled positions on matters concerning the welfare of a particular state. It is bizarre. It is downright illegal for this to happen. And it is a total embarrassment to this nation. But you know, Trump has no shame. And if you look at the people who he has selected to be on board with his administration, the vast majority of them also have no shame. They have no shame. They have no sense of respect for anything or anybody. There's nothing that they can't violate. There's nothing that they can, that is exempt from this kind of treatment. And the reason we ought to be concerned about it is that this is not just words. One of the reasons that we now have a great deal of trepidation about the reaction of North Korea and the words that North Korea has been using to indicate that we shouldn't be surprised if a barrage of nuclear weapons is unleashed against the United States. Words do matter. especially at that level. When you humiliate, insult, and you subject nations to this kind of treatment, well, obviously, they're going to react. I'm not suggesting that the nations supporting Palestine and the sovereignty of Palestine will react militarily, but I'm saying insofar as we recognize the connection between expressions and words with potential lethal actions and military actions, we should at least try to avoid anything that could further exacerbate the tensions that currently exist. And if the United States considers itself a leader within the world community of nations, then it should behave like it understands that. And Americans should step forward and chastise this government for behaving like this. This woman should not be the lead representative of the United States within the United Nations. She should be fired. If we had logical thinking in Washington, D.C., we wouldn't have this. It is not unlike Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, saying that She was okay with the U.S. bombing and killing more than 500,000 children in Iraq. It was worth it, she said. Who talks this way? And further, according to the diplomatic terrorist that we have now on our hands, this is going to be the permanent attitude of the United States with the nations of the world. You disagree with us, we're coming after you. What does that mean? You're going to bomb them? You're going to assassinate their leaders? What does that mean? We're taking names. We won't forget. That's what she said. I tell you, we have incurred the wrath of much of the world simply by our behavior as a nation. It's disgusting. And it is wrong. And it is in contravention of every possible rule that you could think of in the ways that nations are supposed to behave with each other. It's one thing to disagree. It's one thing to, you know, take to heart rejection of many nations who disapprove of an action, but you are in a setting where people should be able to express themselves and their will without having somebody acting like the capo di tutti capi. And it is even worse because we've had this with Madeleine Albright. We've had this kind of talk from Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State as well. And now we have a third woman coming up talking like she's a thug. Do we feel comfortable being represented by a thug? I don't think so. Well, we take this break and come back to second part of the program, which concentrates on the budget, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. When the House votes again today on new changes that were made to this massive tax overhaul plan, President Donald Trump and the Republican leadership will claim a stunning victory. The tax overhaul, the centerpiece of the Republicans' $1.5 trillion budget, was long overdue, they would say. And it will greatly energize the economy and bring across the board benefits to all. But Trump's triumph is not sitting well with a wide swath of experts. Josh Bivens, the director of research at the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute, is one of them. The tax overhaul and budget bill, he says, are, quote, nothing short of wholesale looting. He's with us now. Thank you, Josh, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Quite a statement that you made, that this is an example not of a great overhaul of taxes, the tax plan of the United States, but wholesale looting. Please explain.
Well, if you look at the tax bill and then you combine it with the budget resolution, which the both houses of Congress passed in October, you see just a massive redistribution of income from bottom and middle class, lower middle class families to those at the very top. Like the tax bill by itself, when it's fully phased in, 83% of the benefits go to the top 1%. And then if you look at the budget resolution passed in October, it's $1.8 trillion in cuts over the next decade just to Medicare and Medicaid alone. And so those two things in combination would be one of the great upward redistributions we've ever seen in this country.
I wonder what you think about the process by which this was arrived at.
I think the process was really terrible. This is the tax bill. It's really big. It's $1.5 trillion in federal resources over the next 10 years that Republicans in Congress have decided we don't need. I would have said we probably could have used $1.5 trillion in federal resources to do lots of useful things over the next 10 years. We could have done public investments in either infrastructure or early childhood education. We could have beefed up the protectiveness of things like the Affordable Care Act, but instead it was tax cuts. And the sort of scope, the time set aside for debate on this was so incredibly small. Not a single public hearing in either the House or the Senate for this tax bill. I mean, that's really astounding for legislation of this side. And then the fact that they were so rushed that yesterday the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee was asked, what are the tax brackets in your bill that you have already voted on? He did not know. That's how rushed this has all been. And so this is an incredibly cavalier way to redistribute $1.5 trillion in resources.
Well, let me ask you, why is it that there's been such a resistance to working logically on the matter of formulating a budget, where it is a political issue and not one that should include the experts in economics? It has, you know, the taint of the priorities of Democrats and then the priorities of Republicans. And that's the way it's been. That's how our budget is formulated. When do you think, or what has to happen to neutralize the politicization of our budget and produce a budget that is well within the logic of the science of economics?
So, I mean, that's more of a political question than economic. And on politics, my opinions are worth not much more than the person on the street. I do think one thing. I think we need to get to a point where Republicans in Congress, at least some handful of them, are at least as scared of losing a general election to a Democrat as they are scared of facing a primary from an even more conservative challenger. I think we have this dynamic where many, many seats in Congress are held by Republicans who only fear opposition from the right, not from the left. And so that robs all incentive to do any sort of good faith bargaining like you're talking about with their Democratic colleagues. It basically says everything is going to be passed on a pure party line vote. And so that means consultation and negotiation are not worth anything. It's just sort of raw vote counting and power that decides the day. And so that's my guess about what's going to have to change for us to get a sort of rational consensus-based fiscal policy or any kind of policy.
To your mind, is this a legal budget?
That's legal. That's a good question. I mean, I think I'm not a lawyer. My sense is that probably yes. I mean, I think there's a lot untoward about it. I think lots of norms have been broken, really useful norms, like you should actually have a hearing and you should actually try to inform yourself about the bill you're voting on. I'm not aware, as far as I know, of any sort of actual legal line that has been crossed, but I could be wrong. I'm not a lawyer.
Okay. Let's talk about specifics of the budget as you have analyzed it. What is most disturbing? What are some of the disturbing items in this budget, and why do you find them disturbing?
To me, by far the most disturbing piece in it is just the staggeringly large cut to Medicaid. Medicaid, just to remind people, it is the program that provides health insurance for low-income Americans. There are about 50 million Americans enrolled in Medicaid. It also pays for lots of nursing home costs for elderly Americans, and it's an absolutely vital piece of economic security for them. The budget resolution would cut it by 30%. Very few people think that Medicaid is excessively generous today, and so the idea that it could absorb a cut that large without doing huge harm to both the health and financial security of people on it seems really impossible to believe. The budget contains other cuts. It contains a substantial cut to Medicare, but only about a third as large as the cut to Medicaid. And then it cuts some income support programs like food stamps and supplemental security income. But the huge cut is reserved for Medicaid, which is just an unbelievably important policy for keeping people out of poverty in this country.
Should there be a requirement? I thought it was, going back to referencing the lack of public discussion and even political debate in Congress about the elements of this budget. Should there be a law that any budget cannot be sanctioned unless the Congress has shown that it has met certain criteria, the most important being public debate?
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I sort of referenced before, you know, useful norms that were broken, but I don't think a law was broken. I mean, given that we have seen a Republican Party that has very little use for respecting norms, even when they're useful, maybe they need to become bright line laws. And so maybe there do need to be, you know, a set number of hearings for budgetary changes over some threshold. I think something that actually makes the process deliberative rather than sort of fake deliberative the way we've had, I think that could be a really useful thing.
I asked a question because I'm hinting at whether there's any way that the people can challenge a budget or overturn a budget.
Outside of electing different representatives, and I guess in the meantime, letting your strong preferences be known to those representatives so they change their behavior. There's not many channels besides that. I mean, we're in a representative democracy. We elect people to make decisions. If we don't like the decisions, it mostly comes to providing information that we don't like them to our representatives, but then getting new ones if we want different decisions made. I'm afraid there is very little formal in the process that allows that kind of democratic engagement.
Well, I was kind of taking my lead from your word looting, which is a crime. People should not be allowed, including legislators, should not be allowed to loot a budget. And we see here many instances in which specific legislators and even the president had inserted in this budget provisions that would personally benefit them, which, of course, is a crime of corruption. Could a case be made? I'm asking you, you repeated that you're not a lawyer, and I appreciate that. But I'm talking about the integrity of a budget that is supposed to represent a concerted effort by both houses of Congress to do the right thing and the responsible thing, not the partisan thing and the personal thing, with the people's money.
Yeah, so you're right. This particular tax bill with those very specific provisions that sort of laser targeted increased the incomes of, you know, identifiable members of Congress, that should be shocking to people and that should be changed. And to me, that the easiest way to change that, the possibility of constructing legislation to enrich yourself personally, I don't understand why all congressmen and senators and members of the executive branch aren't forced to sell their assets and put them in a genuinely blind trust when they become public servants. That way it would be impossible for them to write legislation that benefited themselves knowingly, because they would actually not really know. There should be a centralized fund of all the House members and Senate's financial assets that they cannot see, managed by a professional. I'm not talking about surrendering your assets. I'm just talking about putting them in a blind trust so you can't knowingly enrich yourself. Seems to me reforms on that level should absolutely be a priority. You know, we have seen over the past 4 years incredible amounts of self-dealing, and that to me seems like an easy way to end it, just making people put their assets in blind trusts.
Yes, the president had promised that that's what he was going to do, and his children had promised that that's what they were going to do, but it hasn't been done. Quite the opposite. You've been studying economic systems under different administrations for a while. How does this administration either resemble previous administrations in the way they have formulated their budgets? How does this administration depart from previous administrations in the same manner?
You know, I would say, especially in regards to tax policy with the bill just passed, the many dimensions along which this will specifically enrich the president and his family are pretty shocking. I mean, there's a huge weakening of the estate tax. So people with huge wealth who pass it on to their children are benefited enormously by this tax bill that describes the president. You've got the a weakening of the alternative minimum tax, which was really the only tax that Donald Trump seems to have paid in the 2005 tax return, the portion of it that was leaked to the public. And then you've got the reduction in the rate paid by what are called pass-through entities, sort of non-corporate businesses. Those pass-through entities constitute the bulk of the wealth holdings of the president and his family. And then even within there, you've got the last thing, the Corker kickback, which even within those pass-through entities, another provision was added to specifically benefit pass-throughs that are real estate-based. And again, that is most of the wealth of the president and his family. So the many dimensions along which this bill can be seen to specifically enrich him, I've never heard of anything quite like it.
And many other economists are saying the same thing. In fact, we had Michael Bloomberg, the former billionaire mayor of the city of New York, expressing incredible, surprise and concern about this budget, saying that many of the provisions are completely unnecessary. And the money should have been allocated differently. He has even come out and said that. In terms of consequence, you talk about this a lot in your work, about the consequences of policy, social policy, political policy. What do you expect the fallout or the consequence to be with the enactment of these new budgetary rules and laws?
Well, so the cuts called for in the budget resolution, that they have not happened yet. That those can still be fought on legislative grounds, and hopefully they will be, and they'll be blocked. If they happen, if the cuts in the budget actually happen, you would be talking about tens of millions of Americans who faced substantially higher levels of poverty and economic insecurity, as key things like Medicaid and supplemental security income and food stamps were radically cut back. And then you're going to see a huge increase in the incomes of those households lucky enough to own lots of financial wealth. I mean, in the end, this tax bill was about providing really large tax cuts to people who make their income not from working, not from earnings, not from wages, but simply from being wealth holders. That's who's going to be the big beneficiaries of this tax bill. And so if that has already passed, so that's going to happen. They've just gotten a windfall. Maybe the tax bill can be reversed in the future. That should definitely be a goal. And then the second part is standing ground to make sure the cuts called for in the budget resolution don't actually happen, because they would be really devastating to lots of low-income American households.
Are you surprised that this budget appeared not to be well understood? I mean, there wasn't time for people to actually analyze the specifics of this budget. But are you surprised that the broader community hasn't put up too much of a big fight, except on specific items, but not on the budget and the process as a whole?
Actually, I was slightly encouraged, but like, it happened late in the game. I think people were slow to realize how quickly this was going to be pushed through and what the implications were of this whole process, specifically the tax cut bill in particular. But toward the end, I feel like there was genuine grassroots anger. I think you see it in the polling numbers. I mean, Americans like to complain about taxes, and when they're promised a tax cut, that should be pretty easy to sell. And they're not buying this tax cut is something that's going to be good for them by and large. And I think that speaks to how bad the process was and how bad the substance of the bill is, that, you know, you promise to cut someone's taxes, that should be popular. This is not popular at all. I think the Republicans have crammed this through in the defiance of sort of public opinion and in the face of some real activism, which is actually pretty hard to inspire about taxes. Like, the activism that happened around the repeal of the Affordable Care Act made some sense, because I think that was so tangible to people. Tax cuts seem a little more wonky and abstract, and yet it did inspire some anger at the end. I wish the anger had come earlier. I wish it had won the day. But I think in terms of organizing against this tax bill, people did a great job in communicating how bad it was, and I think people are angry about it. And I think it's going to have consequences for people who voted for it.
I was just going to get to that point. Has Trump and have the Republicans betrayed their constituencies by not fulfilling in the budget issues that were important or would have been important to them?
I think so. I mean, I think anyone who is still laboring under the impression that Donald Trump's administration is genuinely concerned about working class and moderate income Americans, they're in denial. I mean, this tax cut is just, you can do the specific math on it. 83% of the benefits go to the richest 1% of families, while the bottom half of the income distribution will see a tax increase when it is fully phased in. And they're going to turn around and go after Medicare and Medicaid. I think people who've been, even people who potentially voted for President Trump, have probably been getting pretty queasy about his, you know, capacity or his willingness to deliver on promises to help working class families. I think this tax cut will probably be the death knell of anyone expecting help on that front. So I think it'll have real consequences.
Has the United States gone through or experienced this kind of budgetary process ever, to your knowledge?
Absolutely not in my memory. I mean, we have had tax cuts that I did not approve of. You know, I was old enough to I remember the Bush tax cut of 2001 and 2003. They were quite tilted toward the top, not near as tilted as this one, but quite tilted. I did not support them. They were not crammed through with zero debate. They actually attracted a couple Democratic votes. Again, I didn't like them, but they were in no way the sort of purely corrupted norm-breaking process that accompanied this one.
So it's fair to say, I'm trying to put words in your mouth, but so be careful. It's fair to say that this budget actually helps the emergence, the full emergence or fuller emergence of the oligarchy in the United States.
You know, I think that's pretty fair to say. I mean, this is a budget that is a budget and a tax process that has been amazingly good for people who make a lot of income by not working, by simply sitting on wealth. If that's a pretty good definition of oligarchs, and they seem to have incredibly disproportionate sway over the decisions of Congress, then yes, this has been a huge triumph for them.
As an economist, what is the work for you?
Hopefully to just continue to tell the truth about what the facts show about the fallout from these policies on the living standards of low and moderate income Americans. I think low and moderate income Americans have had an incredibly tough couple of decades. Even before the Great Recession, there was incredibly slow wage growth. There was rising inequality. We've never addressed that. I think that lingering anger over this contributed to the election of Donald Trump. People thought he would shake up the system and let the forgotten person's voice be heard. I think that hope is now completely passed, but that doesn't mean the problem is passed. There still needs to be some real policy reform done to help the incomes of low and moderate income families. And so hopefully we can get to work on that. And my role as an economist is to continue to demonstrate that there's a need for that. There's still a lot of economic anxiety that this tax cut bill is just going to exacerbate, not solve.
We got a preview of the attitude of this administration with its policy, or what will be the standing policy now with regard to restaurant workers and their tips. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, this is a pretty outrageous policy, and it also highlights the importance of Congress is pretty well covered. People know in the newspapers the laws that are passed. There's also lots of work being done just in the executive branch through rules and regulations that is incredibly important to working people. And just in the past couple of weeks, the Trump administration Department of Labor passed a rule saying that employers could claim a portion of a waitstaff's tips that are above the minimum wage. So if somebody earns $10 an hour, when you include their tips, everything above the minimum wage of $7.25 at the federal level can be taken by the employer. Now, the claim is the employer can take it, and if they want, they can pool those tips and give them to the cooks and people in the back of the house who don't earn tips. But they don't have to. They can just keep them. The rule is very specific. You can take the tips away from your waitstaff and use it to buy a new coffee machine or expand your restaurant or do anything you want with them with no real sort of oversight or discretion. So it's this incredible rule that is likely to transfer $6 billion from waitstaff to the owners of restaurants. And it's something that the National Restaurant Association has been wanting for a long time. They know people pay a lot of tips at restaurants, and that's money that's not going to the owners of the restaurants, and the owners have decided they want that money. And so it's a rule that was made without Congress, without a lot of coverage. It came out of the blue, and it's going to transfer $6 billion in one fell swoop from waitstaff to restaurant owners. And so it's yet again sort of a lever of power working behind the scenes that is not working for low and moderate wage workers.
And related to that, would the custom of clawing back money, I'm talking about wage theft, Will it still continue, or are there provisions in this new tax bill that would address that?
So there's certainly nothing in the tax bill that addresses the problem of wage theft. And in fact, the tip rule, which we're talking about, the new regulation from the Department of Labor, it makes the most common form of wage theft now legal. I mean, the most common form of wage theft, or one of the most common forms anyway, that happens is exactly restaurants confiscating tips from their waitstaff. Currently, that would be illegal. If we had an actual, you know, strong enforcement from our Department of Labor, we could do something about that. This rule, instead of enforcing provisions against that, say, you can do that. You can go ahead, and we're going to make one category of wage theft legal, so employers should go ahead and do it and not worry about repercussions at all.
And this is amounting to billions of dollars a year that employers basically steal from the wages that they ought to be paying to their employees.
Absolutely. I mean, it comes in the form of taking tips. It comes in the form of paying subminimum wages. And the people who suffer the most from it are predictably the most vulnerable workers. I mean, the workers most likely to be affected by wage theft are immigrant workers who are afraid if they actually try to contact the authorities to actually get some wage and hour provisions enforced, that there will be retaliation, either if they're on a work visa, the visa will be taken from them. If they're in the country without authorization, they're worried they'll be turned in to the immigration authorities. So wage theft is a huge problem, and it's one that sort of disproportionately, as you would imagine, affects sort of the most vulnerable workers.
Josh Bivens, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing some, I hope, preliminary thoughts. I hope you'll come back soon, and once you've had a chance to look at the big picture in fine detail, which would come after negotiations today, and we will return to this discussion with more specificity. But I thank you for the specificity that you offered today insofar as we, the people, know about what has happened to the budget. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program. And as you can see, we're in really deep doo-doo. You know, we have a lot of stuff on our plates. And the question is, how do we deal with it? We have no choice. This is the reason I was so angry about the lack of response by these emerging political parties and movements. We should have some kind of answer or some method of challenging this fait accompli. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Ring of Fire Radio. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.